For those of you that don't know me, I'm Michelle Rook, a WNAX farm director in Yankton, South Dakota, and a past president of this organization. And I'm honored today to serve as the moderator for this legislative panel. And we're so glad to have with us today a couple of our outstanding Farm Bureau state presidents. To my immediate left is Blake Hurst. He is Missouri Farm Bureau president, and he actually came into leadership there as president in 2010. He and his wife, Julie, and I think your father, you have a very large family operation. Lots of people are involved in that operation near Atchison, in Atchison County in northwest Missouri, and they do row crops and also have a wholesale greenhouse business. And then Steve Nelson is also joining us, Nebraska Farm Bureau president. He came into leadership as president in 2011 and farms near Axtell, Nebraska, which is in south central Nebraska, and he does row crops as well, corn, hybrid seed corn, as well as soybeans. So we thank you two for taking your time to be with us today, and of course, we'll give you a few minutes to give some opening statements. Blake, would you like to go first?
Well, thank you for being here. Thank you for the chance, giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm going to talk about a couple things today. I'm going to talk about the waters of the U.S., and I'm going to talk about a fried carrot. And I'll start off, what I was hoping was when I said I was going to talk about waters of the U.S. and a fried carrot, you all might kind of laugh because that was sort of a joke. So there will be other jokes, and you probably won't laugh at them either. So if I hold up like my finger, that will be a sign that it was a joke, and then you can laugh, and then it'll work a lot better. All right, today's the day, final day, into the comments on WOTUS. I'm sure that everybody in here is extraordinarily well-informed on the issue. This morning I was in Jeff City in the office, and we were kind of putting the final touches on our comments. We sent them in. They say about what you would expect. The waters of the U.S. rule is too broad. It is exactly the opposite of what two Supreme Court decisions, both the Swank decision and the Rapinos decision in 2006, instructed the EPA to do. Both those decisions narrowed the reach of the Clean Water Act in different ways, and yet the EPA has come out with a rule that has broadened it. Even in the advisory council, the science advisory council that looked over the rule was critical of the science that went behind the rule. One of the points they made out, and I think they pointed out, and sort of interesting, they made the report, had several criticisms. In fact, it was pretty critical of the rule. And then later they came back with a memo that said, oh, by the way, we think that the rule is a great thing and you ought to do it. There was clearly some phone calls made to get them in line. But one of the criticisms they make, they say that, as you all know, the important thing in the 2006 decision was that in order to be considered a water of the U.S., a body of water or a stream or even a ditch has to have a significant nexus with a navigable water, which is what the Clean Water Act says, a navigable water of the U.S. And it's clear in their scientific research and their connectivity research that the EPA has done, they see connectivity as a binary decision. Either you are or you aren't. The Science Review Board says, in actuality, connectivity is a gradient. There's different levels of connectivity. So what the EPA has said in the rule is that everything's connected and everything's significant. What the Scientific Review Board said was, wait a minute, there's a gradient. Some things are more connected than others. Some things are more important than others. And by inference, some things should be regulated by the state instead of the federal government. That's why the rule needs to be pulled. That's why we hope that the recent election next year will give us a chance to have a legislative fix to the rule in case the EPA continues to ignore the tens of thousands of comments from farmers and farm organizations all across the United States. We hope we can get a legislative fix. So this week, started out on Sunday evening when I caught my combine on fire, got out the combine, grabbed my fully charged fire extinguisher, squirted the fire, pulled the key, nothing came out. I said some words that I will not reuse here. I ran around the back of the combine, finally got it out. Think it probably is going to take all the wiring and everything in front of the cab, underneath the cab. Think it's probably going to take a new cab before we use it again. And it was clear full of corn. And so I got on a plane Monday morning and headed for New York City, and my brothers and nephews and son-in-laws had to get the evacuator and clean out the combine and then drag it onto the truck to take it to the John Deere dealer. So I'm going home this afternoon. I'm a little nervous about the reception I'm going to get. But anyway, we're still harvesting. And then on Monday, I went to New York City, up north of New York City, to attend the New York Times Food for the Future. Some of you may have heard about it. It was a convention of like-minded people to talk about the future of food, and it was headlined by Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman. And it was held at a place called the Stone Barn. And the Stone Barn, this is where the carrot comes in. The Stone Barn is a small farm and a sustainable farm, organic farm. And the produce at the Stone Barn goes directly to the restaurant there. And the name of the restaurant is Stone Barn at Blue Hill, or Blue Hill at Stone Barn. I can't remember which. I looked up the menu. And so we had a big banquet on Tuesday night. And of course, if you're running a small farm to restaurant and you're doing that sort of thing, you have to eat what's both local and in season. In November in upstate New York, what's in season is carrots. And that was what's on the center of the plate, was one fried carrot. That was my supper. Now, the chef, Dan Barber, who some of you I'm sure have heard about, sort of made a presentation of the whole meal. And, of course, it started out with a small slice of bread. And we had a little bit of greens, of some identified greens. And then right before we were served the main course, he put this slide up in front of everybody of the most beautiful pork chop, Steve, you have ever seen in your life. I'm thinking, okay, things are looking up. He said, we've got to stop eating center cut meat like this. Takes too many. If we were going to feed everybody here, 600 people, if we're going to feed everybody here a pork chop like this, it would take, dozens of pigs. We can't do that anymore. The world cannot support that much meat production. What we got was a carrot. And as far as I can tell, they sort of had the essence of pig passed over the carrot. Of course, we hadn't had any dinner either, and lunch was inedible, and breakfast was inedible. Oh, I should talk about Mark Bittman. Mark McBittman, you may have seen in the news. Mark Bittman was the keynote speaker. Mark Bittman says that industrial farming, which is the kind of farming that Steve and I do, pollutes, sickens, exploits, and rots. It's an abuse of the land, the water, the animals, and the labor. Mark Bittman doesn't like me, if he knew me. Actually, I went up to speak to Mark Bittman afterwards, and I told him, probably in less than totally tactful terms, what I thought of his speech. And he laughed at me and walked off, so I made a big difference to Mark Bittman. So anyway, then at dinner that night, Mr. Barber, Don Barber, says, we don't have language for good farming. That's what he says. We don't even, us farmers are so stupid, we don't have a clue at how to do good farming. We have no way of knowing how to do it. And chefs in New York City and journalists who got their start exchanging recipes and are now food experts are going to tell us how to do it. But remember this. Dinner at the Blue Hill, that fried carrot with a picture of a pork chop, costs $150. These guys have figured out how to sell fried carrots for $150. So they may well be smarter than we are. Pollan, of course, talked about global warming and the carbon and energy use of farming. And he started his speech. He walked up to the front of the room. And as an example of all this bad, the direct quote was, I'm desecrating the temple, as he set down a bag with a quarter pounder in it. I'm sitting there thinking, if he put that quarter pounder up for auction, how can I get that quarter pounder? All right, so I don't have any. Anyway, he talked about global warming, talked about industrial farming, all the energy we use, how we cannot continue doing what we're doing because it's causing global warming. That we're a huge contributor, industrial agriculture is a huge contributor to global warming. And I'll close with this. Mark Bittman and Michael Pollan, if you've read their writing, if you've seen them speak, Pollan is a reasonable person compared to Bittman. One of the points that Bittman makes, of course, as does Pollan, is that industrial agriculture is brittle, that we're not sustainable, that we can't survive doing agriculture like we're doing. And Pollan goes on, or Bittman went on to say that peasants are the answer. He says 70% of the world food is produced by peasants using only 30% of the resources, Steve. Only 30% of the resources, of course, that only works if you don't count the labor of the peasant as a resource. And I noticed, in closing, I will say I noticed that the Corps has been doing some work on the Mississippi River. This is very important because, as you know, often the brittle industrial food system we have here in the Midwest fails, and we're forced to import emergency rations from Haiti and Bangladesh. It'll be good to have the Mississippi River open so they can bring that food up the river. Thank you for having me.
Good afternoon. I'm Steve Nelson, and I'm very happy to be here, but I do have one question. Is this being recorded?
Yes, it is.
That changes the story that I was going to tell at the start. So
does it have a swear word in it,
no?
Steve?
Okay. I really said that to be funny, but it's a tough crowd here. So I know he said my name a couple times, and I think he thought I wasn't paying attention. But I was, even though it's Friday afternoon. You know, Missouri should be very proud to have a president like Blake. Blake can explain things better than almost anybody I know and can really put into such great words what's really important about what we do in agriculture. And so I really appreciate being able to be on the panel with you, Blake. I'm just going to add a couple things here one will be a little bit related to what Blake talked about, and then a couple other points. Related to the waters of the U.S. discussion, and I think this is a huge issue, and I think it represents a lot about the things that we struggle with today in agriculture and the things that we will continue to struggle with in the future. And certainly it really represents a misunderstanding of what happens on farms and ranches, what happens in the country. And so it's really a bigger issue in so many respects than just what happens to water or rainfall when it lands on the ground in our farms. In Nebraska, we put together a coalition, and we also, as a coalition, submitted our comments today. We've been encouraging our members, of course, to do that and know that it's extremely important that lots and lots of people comment. Our coalition is made up of almost every farm group in the state of Nebraska. It's also made up of a lot of other people who have interest in what happens on the land. So real estate developers, golf courses, anything that really happens on the face of the land, even homeowners in our urban areas have reason to be concerned about what happens with the rules related to the waters of the U.S. And so we put together a coalition, have had a lot of success, and really a lot of good things have happened where, from an agricultural standpoint, we've been able to talk to people and work with people that we don't always work with on a very, very important issue. Also in Nebraska, one of the comments, in addition to the things that Blake mentioned, we've worked with our Department of Environmental Quality in Nebraska since the 70s to implement rules related to CAFOs, to do work on farms and ranches across the state of Nebraska, to deal with waters that run off, those kinds of things that happen on farms and ranches, particularly related to livestock, but really related to all types of farming and ranching. And one of the points that we emphasized that we really do not need the federal government coming into the state and quote-unquote helping us with those kinds of things, because we're already doing a great job, and we have a cooperative spirit that we work with, and we think we're doing very well. Another piece of that I wanted to share, maybe a slightly different perspective. I farm with my son, and I couldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for my son running the farm and taking care of the day-to-day parts of our business. Blake's the same way. We're able to do this because of the family that's around us. And we've been fortunate in our area of South Central Nebraska to finish harvest relatively early. And so I was doing some of those jobs around the farm, moving some dirt around in places in our field. We're a relatively flat area. In fact, most of the land that we farm doesn't drain anywhere. We're in a watershed, but it's generally in the rainwater basin. It's an EPA term or description of the location, but it's an area where water really doesn't go anywhere much. Most of the water that lands on the ground that we farm stays on those farms. Occasionally it might move a half mile or so, but typically it stays very, very close. So we have, as with all farms and ranches, have our own set of problems and things that we need to do maintenance on and repair each year. And so I was out with a scraper and a tractor doing some of those things, typical things that we've done for years and years to make our farms better. It's really conservation work is what it amounts to. It's things that most conservationists would look at and say, that's exactly what you should be doing to deal with the issues on your farm. And it should have registered with me, but didn't right away, that if these rules that the EPA is talking about were to come to pass, I wonder if I could do what I'm doing right now, what I was out there in the field doing. And, you know, it's almost like I wanted to put the tractor in neutral and think for a minute, but I thought I should keep going. But I continued to think about, you know, what happens if this passes? Will I be able to do this? Will these small erosion areas that I'm working on, that I'm stopping from becoming a large erosion area, will I not be able to do that? Will a drainage problem that I need to fix so that part of the crop, part of the field doesn't drown out if we get a big rain, will I not be able to do that? That's a concern. An equal concern is, well, maybe I can do that, but am I going to have to get a permit to do that? And if you look at the rules, and I know that a lot of you have, and I'm not going to go into detail in those, but it's easy to read in there that we could be required as farmers and ranchers to get a permit for almost everything that we do. And I compare it to, and this is, again, maybe you know, something that I think about as a farmer, but we've, over the years, have had to go to the ASCS office or the FSA office to report the crops that we're growing, to sign up for farm programs, different things like that. Those have always been a choice. I mean, we did that because we perceived that there was a benefit to do that, and so there was a choice whether you went to the ASCS office, the FSA office, to participate in a program. What we have here is a program, a proposal, where there would not be a choice. You would have to get the permit. You would have to, if depending upon how they would do that, go to some office somewhere and request a permit for almost everything that you do. And as we've understood from the rules, there's no guarantee that you would get the permit. There's no criteria that says, well, if you do this a certain way, you can do it. If you don't, you can't. So it struck me, as much as it ever had, as I looked at the rules and listened to people talk with a great deal of expertise on the issue, that when we get down on the ground at the farm or the ranch, that this is probably one of the most serious issues that we've ever had to deal with. And it's extremely important that we really stop it in its tracks. I think that I've been asked the question, well, what happens if EPA goes ahead anyway with the rules? And you know, from a lot of the indications are, I mean, that's what they're going to do. I mean, I've been to EPA in Washington, D.C., and had a number of different people tell me that, well, they want our comments, but they're almost as clear as anything that they're still going to go ahead with the proposal. It's not that it will change their mind about it, that they have every intent. They believe it's within their authority to go ahead with the proposal. So what do we do next? And I think that this is one of those fights that we have to be prepared to take all the way. And that could most likely result in the courts at some point. And so as we looked at elections in Nebraska, we elected a new attorney general, a new governor. One of the things that we talked to them about was the importance of having support from those state officials on this federal issue, because it may take state attorney generals and state governors to file those suits to pursue those issues that we need to do. So just wish I could end that piece on a happy note. I'm not sure that there's a way to do that, but I might. I'm still thinking about how to tell this story that I have in such a way that that you. I thought maybe when you raised your finger, that means you put the well. Thanks. I thought maybe that meant that you know that was kind of the censor button, you know. So right when I was going to say something I shouldn't, you know. So anyway, I'll think about how to do that. Just a couple more things that I'll talk about. There are some issues that Congress can deal with that are important to agriculture that I think they can deal with in the lame duck session, and likely that there would be a possibility to do that. A lot of these are tax provisions related to Section 179. I always have trouble saying it right, small business expensing, keeping that level or raising that level back to the $500,000 range, bonus depreciation on capital purchases, some of those kinds of things that are very important to farmers and ranchers that I hope we're going to be able to get through. And then maybe the last thing that I'll talk about, since I'm from Nebraska, is just a couple comments on the Keystone XL pipeline. And it's been interesting to me, and you know, I don't know your perspective on this issue, but in Nebraska, it's been kind of interesting. We've been accused of being the state that has been standing in the way of Keystone. There are certainly people in Nebraska that don't like the idea of Keystone and have done a lot of things to try to stop Keystone. But at the same time, we've really done lots of things in Nebraska to support Keystone and to demonstrate that it's a safe pipeline and would be a very good thing for our country as we look at energy independence. And of course, because of the political happenings through the election and I guess a desire by some to use the process to maybe further their own personal interest, Keystone XL is being discussed again and maybe voted on next week and could even pass both houses and be sent to the president. So that'll be very interesting. On Monday, I was home at the farm, and we had a beautiful day on Sunday, about 60 degrees, and we're done with harvest. We didn't really do much of anything, and then Monday morning, before I headed back to Lincoln, my son and I we took a little road trip and checked some farms, and talked about, you know, how it would be a pretty nice day if it was January, the middle of January instead of the middle of November. So I've thought that about some of the comments that I've heard related to Keystone and people that said it would be a cold day in hell before Keystone Pipeline passed, but maybe it will pass. So I didn't raise my finger, but you could laugh or not if you wanted to. And I'm not going to try to tell the joke that I had. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Look forward to answering your questions.
The problem, Steve, is that we have a lot of people that are farther north, like South Dakota and North Dakota in here, who'd say it'll be a cold day in North Dakota before that happens. So, yeah. I guess I would like to start off and just ask each of you to maybe give your assessment of how you think the midterm elections went, and with the committee assignments and what's going to be happening with the change in leadership, especially with the Senate, how that may impact our ability moving forward to get some business done here, either in the lame duck, but more especially in the new Congress.
One of my predecessors always said after the election that it's never as good as you think it's going to be, and it's never as bad as you think it's going to be. Now, I don't know that those were original comments, but I've found that to be true over the years, that even when you think you maybe have an election that's going to really change things, that doesn't always happen as fast as you think, and the converse is true from time to time, too. You know, I'm very hopeful, I guess, and I try to be positive anyway about lots and lots of things. I'm really hopeful that the Congress can make some progress here and that maybe the president will look at things a little differently with 2 years left on his term and maybe not an election that is credited or connected to him to be as concerned about. So I want to be as positive as I can. From a Nebraska perspective, we had a really great election. We elected a new senator to replace Mike Johanns. His name's Ben Sass, and I think he's going to do a great job. I think that he's someone that can really affect some change into the future. It's not just right on the issues from our perspective, but he's very intelligent. Understands with depth the issues that are there, and I think that he really does represent some great potential to create change in the future. So I'm positive about that, Blake.
And Blake, if you could also maybe add to that, since you started with the Waters of the U.S. proposal, since Congress, there's a lot of congressional effort to try to get rid of the Waters of the U.S. rule and just have it basically annihilated. If that is more of a possibility with this new Congress with Republican control or not, too.
Oh, I think there's more possibility that the Senate will pass legislation, as the House has already done, to try to stop the Waters of the U.S. You know, one of the most interesting things, and I don't know if it'll happen or not, but the Constitution gives the legislature, particularly the House, the power of the purse. And we haven't had that for a number of years because we don't pass a budget anymore. So in other words, they don't have the ability to say, as they would have in the past, EPA, you do not have the ability to spend any funds to administer the Waters of the U.S. rule, which was how we would handle this in the past. And when we pass a big omnibus budget, as we're getting ready to do in the lame duck session in order to keep the government open, when we don't go through the budget process, the traditional budget process, what they call traditional order, when we don't discuss any of the 13 appropriations bills by themselves, when we don't do those things, we don't get the chance for as the Constitution intended, the House of Representatives closest to the people, they've all just been reelected. They have the best finger on what people are thinking. We don't give them that ability. So if I have one hope for this election, it would be that the Senate would begin handling the budget process in the way that the Budget Act intended, the way that the Constitution, the way we've always done it, the way we always did it until 2008. Our Senator Blunt points out that one of the things that happens is, just talking about the defense budget, we pass it in a continuing resolution, so we don't get to go into the budget and look at individual budget items. So we're basically telling the Department of Defense to spend money exactly as they spend it, maybe 2% more, maybe 5% less with sequester. But we take a number, add to or take a number off of that top of that huge big budget number. But we haven't had the ability to say, well, look, this weapon is outmoded. We need more of this weapon. This base needs to, base closing is a little tough to do. But anyway, we're basically running a defense budget that's exactly the same as it was, or at any other budget in any other department, as it was in 2008. Without any changes, and that's no way to run a country. So if anything, nothing else happens from this election, I hope we go back to a more traditional way. And President Obama may veto it. The majority may have to accept things they don't want in some of these budgets in order to get the president to sign it, but that's sort of the way democracy works. A lot of us have almost had the chance to forget that.
And so, Blake, what you're alluding to is that if the bill to try to stop the Waters of the U.S. rule does not pass, that the Senate or the House could start going after control by limiting dollars. And the reason I'm trying to explain this is we have lots of students with us today, and so I thought maybe it'd be good to just explain that process.
Yeah, we've had the ability. I'm sorry, that's a little hot. We've had the ability in the past to not fund certain programs of the government. We don't have that now. We don't have that now because we're just passing continuing resolutions, so we have to fund everything that was funded last year. And so all the resolution says is that department or that federal government is going to spend an amount X, and it may be a little bit more than last year, maybe a little bit less, but we don't give any instruction all to the department, whatever department it might be, including the EPA, on how to spend that money. And so hopefully that'll change. It would be a big deal, a big change.
I don't know if any other farm broadcasters interviewed Carl Brooks yesterday, EPA administrator. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, because, Blake, I know you were talking about the thousands of comments that came in on the rule. I think he told me there was, at count, 1 million so far. And I might be wrong about that. So if there's another farm broadcaster that interviewed him that did not know that to be the case. But 1 million is a lot.
Yeah, and I would guess that most of those are generated by groups. Most of them are copy. Yeah, but we're not in that. We're not in those numbers. But yeah, sure. We turned in just right at 7,000 postcards that our members had signed today, and we sent them out there, and they were turned in today. So a lot of groups do that.
Great. How about we take some questions from the floor? I'm gonna. Ken, you can be first.
Oh, no, they won't. Yeah, it'll have to be in January because
they've got enough to push back right now, correct?
Yeah, because there will be a different group of people voting. Will Rogers once said that a lame duck session is like firing a man and then letting him stay around long enough to burn down your house. So I always get a little nervous. I'll be glad when the lame duck session's over. Although Keystone Pipeline did pass in the House this afternoon with 30-some Democratic votes.
Did you get your question answered?
In the same view, because Senator Holman is a big proponent of Excel, and do we have any idea who some of his advocates are also in the Senate, some of the new faces that we'll see in the Senate?
Well, I don't know if I can speak directly to that. One thing that I would say is that in conversations I've had with both Senator Johanns and Fisher, earlier on in this discussion is that they believed that the votes were there in the Senate already to throw the rule out if the chairman would have been willing to bring it to a vote. But before the election, the chairman was unwilling to bring anything to a vote. Obviously, Keystone now has, you know, would change that because that he allowed that to come to the floor. But I don't know that Waters of the U.S. comes, I mean, there's such a political reason for Keystone to be talked about at this point. I don't expect Waters of the U.S. to come up until after the new Congress is in.
And if I may, just one.
Go ahead.
We haven't really heard any farm groups saying, oh, yeah, let's do the Waters of the U.S. rule. There were some saying, let's wait and see what they're going to do. Have you heard of any other farm groups or anybody in rural America that says, let's go ahead and do Waters of the U.S.? They don't have any people supporting that, do they?
Well, there are groups that have said that it may be okay, or that it made the definitions more clear on what you could do. That was presuming that a lot of the things that we're already doing, we shouldn't be doing, but there are some groups supporting, and I know at least one in Nebraska that because it was an election issue for the governor's race. At the same time, I know that one other group who expressed some support early but has backed off from that. So I don't think there's much support from what I would call traditional farm country.
So it's mostly like environmental groups at this point, or who is opposing?
Well, I think so. I think so. I mean, that's a pretty general term or broad term, but I don't think I could argue that that's not the case.
Okay, Brian Winnikins.
Concerned that we're losing the Wisconsin, I have groups that say a factory farm, a factory dairy farm is any dairy farm that has more than 200 cows. They just use that number. So are you concerned that we're losing that argument?
Yes.
And what do we need to do to change it?
I don't know. I mean, it was interesting. I'll just give some kind of random observations because I, as Julie knows, I can go on this about this for a very, very long time. When I first heard of the conference, it was just on some of the Facebook pages I follow that deal with food and these food issues because I have a real deep interest in them. And they said, look, there's no farmers. Look, there's no farmers invited, which there weren't. And then USFRA became a sponsor, and as part of their sponsorship, they got some tickets, which is how I got there, and they also got to have a panel, and I did not sit. There were several farmers there, people you would recognize, corn growers, pork producers. Bob Stallman was there, and I started out that session when the USFRA, when the farmers, rancher from Nebraska, kind of a diversified farmer, did some produce, had some livestock from California, and a pig farmer from southern Illinois. I said, I don't want to sit by my friends, and so I just moved back into the crowd. And this is a tough crowd. I mean, these tickets to this thing cost $1,364. So, which is why I couldn't go on, except that along with someone else.
Was the fried carrot included in the...
That dinner? Absolutely, okay. Included the fried carrot. $1,364. And there were people there from the general public that had an interest in it and paid that much money. So we're not going to win in this group. We're not even going to get a very nice reaction from this group. Stony silence might be a good description of how the crowd reacted to the three farmers. But to go directly to your question, I ate lunch, which was a hot dog made out of beets. I'm not making that up either. Or that's what...
What did it taste like?
Like a hot dog made out of beets. Or at least the bite I had. I was really hungry. Julie met me at the airport at 10:30 Wednesday night, and she had snack foods so I could get to the... to help me survive till morning. So I was sitting behind the lady who handles sort of what they call stakeholder. They call stakeholder groups for General Foods. Cheerios, all the different things that General Foods made. And we got to talking about GMOs. And I said, well, are you seeing an increase just in comments from consumers, or at least from activist groups, maybe general consumers, maybe activist groups? Oh, she said, absolutely. It is increasing very rapidly. So if you follow this issue pretty close, just as the scientific, the scientific argument is just over. And I think the scientific, although there's been plenty of scientific proof that GMOs are safe for a very, very long time, I think that finally the industry, biotech companies have sort of woken up that if they don't protect their technology, they're going to lose it. I mean, I just think in the last year and a half, there's been sort of almost a crystallization of this, the scientific evidence, and yet consumer acceptance, I think, is going the other way. And it's scary as heck, and I'm already talking, and I have no idea what to do about it. USFRA is a start, just talking to people as much as we can. But you know, Mr. Pollan and Mr. Bittman, to use two, Marion Nestle was there as well. People that follow these issues, those are all names you know very well, Fred Kirschenman. They got a pretty good gig going, you know. They're businessmen as well, and their business to drive up speaking fees and sell books is to make Steve and I the enemy, make us the villains. I pointed out to a couple of people, which was a total waste of breath, that if you wanted to change how millions of acres of farms of farmland was treated in the United States, really bad way to accomplish that goal is to make everybody that owns or controls that land mad at you. And that's what they've done, but it is a good way of selling books. So we'll see.
I agree with Blake that we have been losing this battle that you talk about. But and I would note that a great deal of that is our fault for two reasons. One is that we've been extraordinarily successful at producing food for people in our country. And so having to know where your food comes from, understanding where your food comes from, has not been something that the general public, that consumers need to know. The other part that is our fault is we have failed to recognize what was happening for more than a generation now, and so we're way, way behind the curve. One of the things that impresses me is when I look at the young people that are here and they nod their heads on some of these things, because that is going to be a lot of the way that we communicate with people who don't understand the message that Blake explained so well. And this is something that I think, I mean, it certainly is going to be a lifelong effort for people that are the age that Blake and I are, but probably will be a lifelong effort for the youngest of you that are in the room as well. But it's an extremely important effort. Nothing else will be accomplished easily that makes life better for farmers and ranchers that Blake and I represent. None of that will be accomplished very easily until people understand more about where their food comes from. So it's important from that perspective. I think those of us in agriculture know that it's important from a very broad perspective as well. But I certainly look forward to the help from all of you in the room to help us tell the story, and you can be a part of telling the story about where food comes from and why it's important for people to understand what that really means.
It's a little like trying to turn the Titanic here, isn't it? I mean, it's a long process.
I'll make another comment. I talk about this when I go around to farm, our county Farm Bureau meetings, and there'll be 75 or 100 people in the room, and I'll mention Michael Pollan, and I get a lot of blank looks. So I got back all wound up about this thing Wednesday night. We got into Jeff City about 1 o'clock in the morning, and first thing in the morning yesterday, on Thursday, I'm speaking to about 250 Farm Bureau insurance employees from around the state. These guys work for Farm Bureau, but almost every one of them is farms. Got a few acres, got some cows. That's why they came and worked for our insurance company. I mean, it's home to them, right? I said, well, how many of you have heard of Michael Pollan? Crickets. How many of you have heard of Michael Pollan? So is that good news or bad news? I don't know. I mean, it may be good news in that, the kind of people that read the New York Times know who Michael Pollan is and think he's wonderful, but the great vast majority of voters and consumers haven't a clue who he is and couldn't care less. Or it may mean people in our industry really need to start paying attention to what's going on in the pages of the New York Times. So I don't know. I mean, obviously our members know that people are concerned about pesticide use, that they don't like GMOs, that they care about animal care. They know all that. But what these folks were talking about in this meeting goes much, much further than that. And I don't think people have a grasp of how radical what they're saying actually is. I talked too much. I apologize.
Go ahead.
Bibman's whole talk was, the question was, how do we feed 9 billion people? And he says the answer is we already have enough food to do that. And that's the truth. We do have enough people to feed 9 billion people. I know a fellow as an economics professor, but did his undergraduate work in animal nutrition. And he noticed the fact that that pigs, of course, as you guys all know, are really, their digestive system is really close to humans. And actually, pig food is really good food for humans. I mean, as far as being nutritionally balanced. And he literally went a whole semester in college at Oklahoma State University eating corn and soybean, eating a pig ration. And his health was great. Actually lost a little weight he needed to lose. But he said by the end of the semester, it's pretty hard to eat it, to choke it down. It took a lot of milk to kind of wash it down. Well, I feel the same way about fried carrots, but that's Mark Bittman's, that's Pine Papolin's solution. No meat, no meat. All of the Midwest, we all got to grow broccoli and kale and carrots and no meat at all. Well, you go, you know, you don't grow real food. That's what I heard more than once. What do you grow on your farm? Corn, soybeans. You don't grow real food. That's not real food. That's not food for people. So that's their solution. Take all the grain and all the land used to grow that grain that goes to producing meat. And, you know, so get used to liking cornmeal and with a little bit of soybean meal on the side, because that's what we're going to eat.
Mm-hmm. Roger? The ones you keep trying to get rid of in the farm.
Yes.
Yeah.
They sell
it's all about how you market it.
That's right. Well, that's what it is. I guess I have a son that lives in the heart of New York, grew up on a farm, loves beef. I think we're giving do you think we maybe are giving these people too much credit to represent the majority of people when in reality they may be only represent a select few that are able to make their voices known? And then likewise, if we tie all that in, as you said, we have enough food today, maybe if we go vegetarian to feed the world, but if Waters of the U.S. takes out some 6 million or better acres of production in the Mississippi River Basin, tie this whole picture together, and if everybody gets what they want, how's the saying go? A country that has plenty of food has lots of problems. A country with not enough food has only one problem. I mean, can this really evolve to the extent that these people would like to see it?
Well, I think two things there, and I should have let Steve go, but you.
No, go ahead.
Two things there. The first one is, I don't know. That's why I made the point about the 250 people never heard of Michael Pollan. These guys are, I mean, both those, not so much Bittman. Michael Pollan is a beautiful writer, a beautiful communicator. And so people on each coast, you know, buy his books, follow his food rules. But is he really influencing a lot of people? I don't know. Organic's 4% of the market or whatever it is. Oh, they always say it's growing quickly, growing quickly. Well, if you see the surveys, they'll say 30, 40, 50% of the people say they buy organic or buy organic sometimes or buy a little bit of organic. But when you see marketing surveys, what they actually spend their money on, not so much. So I don't know the answer to that. Okay, and I'm completely... How many of you?
Because it's in the curriculum at the colleges.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them are freshmen. I mean, a lot of the, you have to read it for your freshmen, right?
We didn't read it. I'm an ag com major, and we talk about it. We actually have a class called Sustainable Agriculture, and our professor showed us his video, and it's like, he presents himself very personal, and he does. He writes. I've read some of his articles. But he doesn't have any formal agriculture education. He has no clue, but because he's so educated and people think they relate to him, they'll listen to him.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And this is why they want to get farmland into the same curriculum to counteract what Michael Pollan is doing.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that, politics goes in cycles. Who knows what 2016 will bring? But the hubris there. One of the guys was on the panel, whose claim to fame has writing extensively the fact that the Green Revolution. He's an Indian guy. That the Green Revolution is a con. It really didn't accomplish anything. It was a bad idea to start with. We shouldn't have been doing all that stuff. He also said during the meeting that we ought to have a mandatory worldwide minimum wage and a maximum wage. But anyway, one of the things he said is, well, the desire for meat is learned. That we're not evolutionary, don't desire meat, that we're taught to, just, you know, because people's advertising makes people desire meat. I don't know. I mean, I'm not buying that. And so basically what these guys are saying, we got 7 billion people now, we're going to have all of whom, the minute they get $2 to ride together, the first thing they buy is a chicken, and then they work really hard the next year so they can buy a, you know, move up to pork and beef. I mean, I'm sorry, that's the way it works. And it isn't advertising that did that. That's what people want. And so what these guys are saying is that we can change the dietary habits of 7 billion people and the dietary desires of 7 billion people. That is really, I mean, you talk about self-confidence. Now, that's self-confidence.
Steve, I wonder if you might also address, because we're kind of, since this is still, well, it isn't a legislative panel, it doesn't feel like anymore, but because we had state initiatives on GMO labeling that failed in Oregon and California, or not, in Colorado, do you think with the new makeup that we have of the Congress that maybe on the Senate side, that maybe we could get national GMO labeling? Should we be proactive to do that before we have a patchwork of all of these state GMO labeling rules?
Well, I'm certain that it makes a difference with the, you know, since the election, on how we can move on that. I want to go back to one more thing before I forget, and then I'll try to come back to your question. One of the things that we can do, or that maybe we've lacked being able to do, is have those people that have gained the floor, so to speak, like the people you're talking about, and it's really not a liberal or conservative thing, you know. It to me, it has way more to do with wealth, and that's part of what you talked about as far as the choice of what you eat too. It really all has to do with wealth. If you've got money, you kind of eat what you want, what you like, what tastes good. If you don't have money, you don't. And the ability to feed the world, you know, is really just dependent on what people are going to eat. Blake talked about that well. What we need to do from our side of it, though, is to be able to gain the floor with well-educated people who can communicate, as well as people on the other side, and talk about these issues. And I think we're training people in ag communications better than we ever have before. In Nebraska, we are using farmland in some classes at the University of Nebraska now. I think that's one step. I mean, there's all kinds of things that are happening, and they don't happen overnight. But I think, again, I just wanted to come back to the fact that we can win this argument, but it won't happen overnight. And I think we need to remember that we have a good argument to make, and that we just need to keep doing it. I think Blake may be better to answer the GMO question,
labeling.
The labeling question, than I am. I'm going to let you have that.
Well, do you know there is a proposal for a national GMO labeling law,
right,
which would sort of, just like you said.
Mm-hmm.
So the Vermont is the only state that's passed an actual GMO labeling law. It's in the courts now. Several states in the Northeast have passed one that said if enough states around us pass one, then we'll have one too. I carried around all last fall when I was doing my talks around the state. I said I was for mandatory GMO labeling too. My labels would say this product may contain GMOs which have saved millions of tons of soil. This product may contain GMOs which have saved the use of thousands of tons of pesticides. This product may contain GMOs which can cure blindness if vitamin A is added to rice with the use of genetic engineering. So I'm in favor of genetic labeling as well.
Good answer. Kyle?
I No, we have to start over again. But I wouldn't anticipate. It's really interesting what happened in the election. Harry Reid stopped all kinds of things from coming to vote, floor vote, so people wouldn't be vulnerable. Senators in his party wouldn't be exposed to the being recorded as a voting no against things that were popular. So the only thing they vote on was name and post offices and nominations. And then every campaign in this country said Senator Joe Blow voted with President Obama 96% of the time. And so it ended up hurting him quite badly. And he may have just been to name six post offices and two associate judges, but he was with him every time.
So basically what happens is Iowa Senator, or Iowa Congressman, I should say, Steve King said there at Harry Reid had 380 bills that were pushed and stuck into his desk drawer and never voted on this year, which I contend he must have a really big desk. But obviously those are all gone at the end of the year, and then we just start over. Is that right?
Because the session.
Because the session is over.
Okay. New Congress.
But they could still pass some of those in the,
oh, yeah, sure. In the lame duck.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah, right, yeah. Right. As, which would be Keystone.
And tax extenders.
Yeah, right. Yeah, just,
I guess, just to talk about legislative stuff, there are some tax extenders that are extremely important to farmers. Section 179, which has to do with deductions for capital and investments and a few of the depreciation rules and stuff, and some of this stuff is pretty important. Hopefully, and I would imagine it will get done, but I don't know.
And I was also thinking that the Democratic controlled Senate at this point in time might be willing to pass some of that to save face headed toward the 2016 cycle to curry a little favor with the voters. Yes, no? It's a possibility.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the motivation would be, but I think that. Like so many of these things that we've talked about, the fact that they haven't even been brought to the floor for a vote has been the reason that they haven't moved forward, not because people didn't want to vote for them.
Anybody else? Troy?
Different topic altogether. Are any of your cattlemen that are members starting to be vocal about the second beef checkoff at all yet?
Boy, we're covering the waterfront today.
Yeah, there's some concerns about that, and I share those concerns. I think that although the existing checkoff is not without its own issues and concerns, pretty general agreement that there needs to be more money put into the checkoff. And my concern about having two checkoffs, the potential to have two checkoffs with two sets of rules is that it's just kind of chaotic, and that there'll be additional inefficiencies because you'll have to manage both, and it's just kind of a waste of money. The money's not going where it needs to go. So I understand the desire that to maybe get something to move forward. I think that's a poor idea.
I agree. I just was remarking about your question that the idea of cattlemen starting to be vocal just struck me as sort of funny.
Okay. Susan just texted me and said, if there's anybody here that has a AM Orange GT parked by the big doors, it needs to be moved now because security needs to get it out of the way because the Ag Secretary is here. Don't know if that takes in.
Ask him that question.
Roger.
Another interesting, as you talked there again about the waters of the U.S. and the previous Supreme Court rulings on EPA and the regulation, one other interesting note, if there are any, after the lame duck session, any new Supreme Court nominees, instead of having a Democratic-controlled Senate, we will have a Republican. Could be an interesting choice going forward for Supreme Court nominees.
Is there anybody even up, though, for a while?
Well, they can die.
Okay. Aren't you in the glass half-empty category today? Brian Winnikins again.
I'm going to stay on the glass half-empty because I'm a real pessimist.
This is your new incoming president-elect.
Well, I'll change it. Pessimist would be safe.
You're a realist.
Yes. To is going to end up happening, because they've already kind of started with this immigration stuff, where if you do something, we'll have a poisoned well and that sort of thing.
Well, I think it just kind of, it really is up to the president, because if he chooses to either just say, I'm not going to sign anything because I'm not going to sign anything for whatever reason, you have gridlock. And if his choice is to be really dramatic with certain things, then I think that nothing happens either. I, again, it would be my hope that that's not the case, but I think that we'll have to wait and see. Well, on some issues there will be. I don't know that there would be on every issue. Probably not.
Anyone else? Spence.
Going back to the checkoff a little bit, I understand the confusion that might have to reign if there's checkoffs being that are government or two different pieces of legislation. But do you really anticipate being or seeing a lot of confusion with the 96 Act, just because there are already a lot of other commodity checkoffs that live under that legislation? And plus these organizations that contract under the checkoff are going to have very big, very good legal departments that will help them understand it. So do you really anticipate, once this checkoff gets going, that much confusion?
Two different boards, two different checkoffs? Yeah, I think it'll be confusing. But it's not going to, you can write it down, it isn't going to happen.
Steve, did you have a comment on that? Or?
I did until Blake said it wasn't going to happen. My worries went away.
Yeah. Kyle.
I just was going to say to wait till the next session and ask him. I would come back and just add one more piece to the earlier question, and I think not only do you have different boards with different sets of leadership, but you would have the potential is that you could have a pretty divergence of opinion on what's important, and the dollars could end up fighting each other in certain areas. And I think that's part of what the checkoff is about, is finding those areas, is kind of making that decision on what the direction needs to be.
I think one of the interesting dynamics here is that because we haven't been able to do anything at the national level, there's, 20-some states looking closely at increasing their state checkoffs. And so that's sort of interesting, and it may be that most states would rather. Our delegates will give me my instructions, as will Steve's here in a couple of weeks. It would not surprise me if across the country there is a lot of support for saying the federal government, maybe I'll just wait and let the states work out what they want to do. That's obviously not, there's no quote in there, guys, because I don't know what my delegates are going to tell me, but. If I was guessing, I would guess that might be what happens.
Minnesota had a vote this summer for a dollar increase, and it failed. And Nebraska has already said that they won't look at it. Is that right, Steve?
Well, I think that, yeah, although we have it in our policy.
In Farm Bureau policy, we do support increased state checkoff if there's no federal increase. But that's as far as that's gone, and I think right now, the desire really is to solve this at the federal issue, or at the federal level, solve the issue at the federal level, and rather than having to have both the state and a national checkoff. But if that doesn't happen, I'm not sure what the state or other states end up doing.
Well, and then the state can also decide how much of whatever the increase is of their checkoff that they want to stay there versus going nationally. Minnesota's was set up so that the whole dollar would stay in Minnesota. None of it would go to the national, and every state could determine that, is my understanding.
Yeah, they could. My guess would be most of them will agree with Minnesota and want to keep it all themselves.
Keep it all to themselves.
We, of course, in Missouri, as you'll remember, we had enabling legislation for a state checkoff, and then it sort of got caught up in the whole, it was captured by the captive servants.
Anybody else have a question? How about any of our students? Do you have any questions? Go ahead.
I know you said that because of this session is new, that a lot of the bills on the federal level ended up in Harry Reid's desk and will not get passed. Do you know how many of those were agriculture bills and how many of them will possibly be retried again in this next session?
I don't know the number, but a lot of those bills can easily be reintroduced. I mean, they'll have a new number and they may be changed slightly, but the language is there. I mean, it's not like they have to reinvent the wheel. So I would expect that a lot of that legislation will come back with a different number on it.
Secretary Vilsack, a couple years ago, year and a half ago, mentioned the fact that he feared that farmers were no longer relevant because of our, well, I think there's, he had several reasons, but it's interesting that the two bills that actually got done by this Congress were the Farm Bill, and the bill for locks and dams, the bill having to do with the infrastructure of our rivers, both of them priorities of every farm group. So I think we're pretty darn relevant in the last 2 years.
Anybody else? Okay, so what do you two see as being the top priorities of the new Congress as far as agriculture? What do you think the ag groups are going to unite behind? Will immigration reform be the first, you think, that we'll deal with?
You know, I have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, clearly the press reports are that the president's going to do an executive order, and I don't know what the result of that will be. I do not know. But it's just very, very, very difficult issue. It is an extremely difficult issue. And it's a difficult issue for very, very good reasons. Having said that, as you know, American Farm Bureau is strongly in favor of immigration reforms. And if you spend some time, as Steve as I do, and Steve and I do, on our board, and you listen to people who farm in California and places where seasonal labor is really important, something needs to be done. So we hope that it gets done. But boy, it is a extremely difficult issue for people in public life to handle because of the different pressures that are on them.
And unfortunately, I think the issue is easily confused. What we talk about from a Farm Bureau perspective is having guest worker programs that are functional for producers in the U.S. and for the workers that come to the U.S. to do those jobs. It's not necessarily about citizenship and those kinds of things, but on the national level, that's where the debate seems to go straight to. And so when you try to solve all of those issues at one time, it's very, very difficult. And I mean, obviously, that's what we've had. So I'm like Blake on immigration as well as any other issue that, you know, I'm just not sure what happens here. We've talked about it in different ways before this afternoon, and I think that it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, how the Congress and the President work together or don't work together to either get something done or not. So.
Anybody else have any questions? Do either of you have any closing or parting thoughts? And then we'll wrap this up just a skosh early and let us reset before the Secretary comes in.
I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to be here and for inviting me to come and be here. And thank you to all of you for what you do and what you're learning to do. I really appreciate the interest that all of you have in agriculture. So it's just a big thank you that I have.
I'd echo that. Thanks. Enjoyed it. Good questions, good crowd, and it's good to be here, so thank you.
How about a round of applause for Stephen Blake? We will have the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, back in here at 3 o'clock. So if we can get reset, the malt box up here if you need to get plugged in.